Chapter 9, Melchizedek. The third person in the little trio was Lottie. She was a small thing and did not know what adversity meant, and was much bewildered by the alteration she saw in her young adopted mother. She had heard it rumored that strange things had happened to Sarah, but she could not understand why she looked different, why she wore an old black frock and came into the schoolroom only to teach instead of to sit in her place of honor and learn lessons herself. There had been much whispering among the little ones when it had been discovered that Sarah no longer lived in the rooms in which Emily had so long sat in state. Lottie's chief difficulty was that Sarah said so little when one asked her questions. At 7, mysteries must be made very clear if one is to understand them. "Are you very poor now, Sarah?" she had asked confidentially the first morning her friend took charge of the small French class. "Are you as poor as a beggar?" She thrust a fat hand into the slim one and opened round, tearful eyes. "I don't want you to be as poor as a beggar." She looked as if she was going to cry, and Sarah hurriedly consoled her. "Beggars have nowhere to live," she said courageously. "I have a place to live in." "Where do you live?" persisted Lottie. "The new girl sleeps in your room, and it isn't pretty anymore." "I live in another room," said Sarah. "Is it a nice one?" inquired Lottie. "I want to go and see it." "You must not talk," said Sarah. "Miss Minchin is looking at us. She will be angry with me for letting you whisper." She had found out already that she was to be held accountable for everything which was objected to. If the children were not attentive, if they talked, if they were restless, it was she who would be reproved. But Lottie was a determined little person. If Sarah would not tell her where she lived, she would find out in some other way. She talked to her small companions and hung about the elder girls and listened when they were gossiping, and acting upon certain information they had unconsciously let drop, she started late one afternoon on a voyage of discovery, climbing stairs she had never known the existence of until she reached the attic floor. There she found two doors near each other, and opening one, she saw her beloved Sarah standing upon an old table and looking out of a window. "Sarah," she cried, aghast. Mama Sarah, she was aghast because the attic was so bare and ugly and seemed so far away from all the world. Her short legs had seemed to have been mounting hundreds of stairs. Sarah turned round at the sound of her voice. It was her turn to be aghast. What would happen now if Lottie began to cry and anyone chanced to hear? They were both lost. She jumped down from her table and ran to the child. "Don't cry and make a noise," she implored. "I shall be scolded if you do, and I have been scolded all day. It's not such a bad room, Lottie." "Isn't it?" gasped Lottie, and as she looked round it, she bit her lip. She was a spoiled child yet, but she was fond enough of her adopted parent to make an effort to control herself for her sake. Then somehow it was quite possible that any place in which Sarah lived might turn out to be nice. "Why isn't it, Sarah?" she almost whispered. Sarah hugged her close and tried to laugh. There was a sort of comfort in the warmth of the plump, childish body. She had had a hard day and had been staring out of the window with hot eyes. "You can see all sorts of things you can't see downstairs," she said. "What sorts of things?" demanded Lottie, with that curiosity Sarah could always awaken even in bigger girls. "Chimneys, quite close to us, with smoke curling up in wreaths and clouds and going up into the sky, and sparrows hopping about and talking to each other just as if they were people, and other attic windows where heads may pop out any minute and you can wonder who they belong to, and it all feels as high up as if it was another world." "Oh, let me see it," cried Lottie. "Lift me up." Sarah lifted her up, and they stood on the old table together and leaned on the edge of the flat window in the roof and looked out. Anyone who has not done this does not know what a different world they saw. The slate spread out on either side of them and slanted down into the rain gutter pipes. The sparrows, being at home there, twittered and hopped about quite without fear. Two of them perched on the chimney top nearest and quarreled with each other fiercely until one pecked the other and drove him away. The garret window next to theirs was shut because the house next door was empty. "I wish someone lived there," Sarah said. "It is so close that if there was a little girl in the attic, we could talk to each other through the windows and climb over to see each other if we were not afraid of falling. The sky seemed so much nearer than when one saw it from the street that Lottie was enchanted. From the attic window, among the chimney pots, the things which were happening in the world below seemed almost unreal. One scarcely believed in the existence of Miss Minchin and Miss Amelia in the schoolroom, and the roll of wheels in the square seemed a sound belonging to another existence. "Oh, Sarah," cried Lottie, cuddling in her guarding arm, "I like this attic. I like it. It is nicer than downstairs." "Look at that sparrow," whispered Sarah. "I wish I had some crumbs to throw to him." "I have some," came in a little shriek from Lottie. "I have part of a bun in my pocket. I bought it with my penny yesterday, and I saved a bit." When they threw out a few crumbs, the sparrow jumped and flew away to an adjacent chimney top. He was evidently not accustomed to intimates and attics, and unexpected crumbs startled him. But when Lottie remained quite still and Sarah chirped very softly, almost as if she were a sparrow herself, he saw that the thing which had alarmed him represented hospitality after all. He put his head on one side and from his perch on the chimney looked down at the crumbs with twinkling eyes. Lottie could scarcely keep still. "Will he come? Will he come?" she whispered. "His eyes look as if he would," Sarah whispered back. "He is thinking and thinking whether he dare. Yes, he will. Yes, he is coming." He flew down and hopped toward the crumbs, but stopped a few inches away from them, putting his head on one side again, as if reflecting on the chances that Sarah and Lottie might turn out to be big cats and jump on him. At last his heart told him that they were really nicer than they looked, and he hopped nearer and nearer, darted at the biggest crumb with a lightning peck, seized it, and carried it away to the other side of his chimney. "Now he knows," said Sarah, "and he will come back for the others." He did come back, and even brought a friend, and the friend went away and brought a relative, and among them they made a hearty meal over which they twittered and chattered and exclaimed, stopping every now and then to put their heads on one side and examine Lottie and Sarah. Lottie was so delighted that she quite forgot her first shocked impression of the attic. In fact, when she was lifted down from the table and returned to earthly things, as it were, Sarah was able to point out to her many beauties in the room which she herself would not have suspected the existence of. "It is so little and so high above everything," she said, "that it is almost like a nest in a tree. The slanting ceiling is so funny. See, you can scarcely stand up at this end of the room, and when the morning begins to come, I can lie in bed and look right up into the sky through that flat window in the roof. It is like a square patch of light. If the sun is going to shine, little pink clouds float about, and I feel as if I could touch them. And if it rains, the drops patter and patter as if they were saying something nice. Then if they are stars, you can lie and try to count how many go into the patch. It takes such a lot. And just look at that tiny rusty grate in the corner. If it was polished and there was a fire in it, just think how nice it would be. You see, it's really a beautiful little room." She was walking round the small place, holding Lottie's hand and making gestures which described all the beauties she was making herself see. She quite made Lottie see them too. Lottie could always believe in the things Sarah made pictures of. "You see," she said, "there could be a thick, soft blue Indian rug on the floor, and in that corner there could be a soft little sofa with cushions to curl up on, and just over it could be a shelf full of books so that one could reach them easily, and there could be a fur rug before the fire and hangings on the wall to cover up the whitewash and pictures. They would have to be little ones, but they could be beautiful. And there could be a lamp with a deep rose-colored shade, and a table in the middle with things to have tea with, and a little fat copper kettle singing on the hob. And the bed could be quite different. It could be made soft and covered with a lovely silk coverlet. It could be beautiful, and perhaps we could coax the sparrows until we made such friends with them that they would come and peck at the window and ask to be let in." "Oh, Sarah," cried Lottie, "I should like to live here." When Sarah had persuaded her to go downstairs again, and after setting her on her way, had come back to her attic, she stood in the middle of it and looked about her. The enchantment of her imaginings for Lottie had died away. The bed was hard and covered with its dingy quilt. The whitewashed wall showed its broken patches. The floor was cold and bare. The grate was broken and rusty. And the battered footstool tilted sideways on its injured leg, the only seat in the room. She sat down on it for a few minutes and let her head drop in her hands. The mere fact that Lottie had come and gone away again made things seem a little worse, just as perhaps prisoners feel a little more desolate after visitors come and go, leaving them behind. "It's a lonely place," she said. "Sometimes it's the loneliest place in the world." She was sitting in this way when her attention was attracted by a slight sound near her. She lifted her head to see where it came from, and if she had been a nervous child, she would have left her seat on the battered footstool in a great hurry. A large rat was sitting on his hind quarters and sniffing the air in an interested manner. Some of Lottie's crumbs had dropped upon the floor, and their scent had drawn him out of his hole. He looked so queer and so like a gray-whiskered dwarf or gnome that Sarah was rather fascinated. He looked at her with his bright eyes, as if he were asking a question. He was evidently so doubtful that one of the child's queer thoughts came into her mind. "I dare say it is rather hard to be a rat," she mused. "Nobody likes you. People jump and run away and scream out, 'Oh, a horrid rat!' I shouldn't like people to scream and jump and say, 'Oh, a horrid Sarah!' the moment they saw me, and set traps for me and pretend that they were dinner. It's so different to be a sparrow. But nobody asked this rat if he wanted to be a rat when he was made. Nobody said, 'Would you rather be a sparrow?'" She had sat so quietly that the rat had begun to take courage. He was very much afraid of her, but perhaps he had a heart like the sparrow and it told him that she was not a thing which pounced. He was very hungry. He had a wife and a large family in the wall, and they had had frightfully bad luck for several days. He had left the children crying bitterly and felt he would risk a good deal for a few crumbs, so he cautiously dropped upon his feet. "Come on," said Sarah, "I'm not a trap. You can have them, poor thing. Prisoners in the Bastille used to make friends with rats. Suppose I make friends with you." How is it that animals understand things, I do not know, but it is certain that they do understand. Perhaps there is a language which is not made of words, and everything in the world understands it. Perhaps there is a soul hidden in everything, and it can always speak without even making a sound to another soul. But whatsoever was the reason, the rat knew from that moment that he was safe, even though he was a rat. He knew that this young human being sitting on the red footstool would not jump up and terrify him with wild, sharp noises or throw heavy objects at him, which, if they did not fall and crush him, would send him limping in his scurry back to his hole. He was really a very nice rat and did not mean the least harm. When he had stood on his hind legs and sniffed the air, with his bright eyes fixed on Sarah, he had hoped that she would understand this and would not begin by hating him as an enemy. When the mysterious thing which speaks without saying any words told him that she would not, he went softly toward the crumbs and began to eat them. And as he did, he glanced every now and then at Sarah, just as the sparrows had done, and his expression was so very apologetic that it touched her heart. She sat and watched him without making any movement. One crumb was very much larger than the others. In fact, it could scarcely be called a crumb. It was evident that he wanted that piece very much, but it lay quite near the footstool, and he was still rather timid. "I believe he wants it to carry to his family in the wall," Sarah thought. "If I do not stir at all, perhaps he will come and get it." She scarcely allowed herself to breathe. She was so deeply interested. The rat shuffled a little near and ate a few more crumbs. Then he stopped and sniffed delicately, giving a side glance at the occupant of the footstool. Then he darted at the piece of bun with something very like the sudden boldness of the sparrow, and the instant he had possession of it, fled back to the wall, slipped down a crack in the skirting board, and was gone. "I knew he wanted it for his children," said Sarah. "I do believe I could make friends with him." A week or so afterward, on one of the rare nights when Ermengarde found it safe to steal up to the attic, when she tapped on the door with the tips of her fingers, Sarah did not come to her for 2 or 3 minutes. There was indeed such a silence in the room at first that Ermengarde wondered if she could have fallen asleep. Then, to her surprise, she heard her utter a little low laugh and speak coaxingly to someone. "There," Ermengarde heard her say, "take it and go home, Melchizedek. Go home to your wife." Almost immediately, Sarah opened the door, and when she did so, she found Ermengarde standing with alarmed eyes upon the threshold. Who are you talking to, Sarah? She gasped out. Sarah drew her in cautiously, but she looked as if something pleased and amused her. You must promise not to be frightened, not to scream the least bit, or I can't tell you, she answered. Ermengarde felt almost inclined to scream on the spot, but managed to control herself. She looked all round the attic and saw no one, and yet Sarah had certainly been speaking to someone. She thought of ghosts. Is it something that will frighten me? She asked timorously. Some people are afraid of them, said Sarah. I was at first, but I am not now. Was it a ghost? Quaked Ermengarde. No, said Sarah, laughing. It was my rat. Ermengarde made one bound and landed in the middle of the dingy bed, of the little dingy bed. She tucked her feet under her nightgown and the red shawl. She did not scream, but she gasped with fright. Oh, oh, she cried under her breath. A rat, a rat. I was afraid you would be frightened, said Sarah, but you needn't be. I am making him tame. He actually knows me and comes out when I call him. Are you too frightened to want to see him? The truth was that, as the days had gone on, and with the aid of scraps brought up from the kitchen, her curious friendship had developed, and she had gradually forgotten that the timid creature she was becoming familiar with was a mere rat. At first, Ermengarde was too much alarmed to do anything but huddle in a heap upon the bed and tuck up her feet. But the sight of Sarah's composed little countenance and the story of Melchizedek's first appearance began at last to rouse her curiosity, and she leaned forward over the edge of the bed and watched Sarah go and kneel down by the hole in the skirting board. He won't run out quickly and jump on the bed, will he? She asked. No, answered Sarah. He's as polite as we are. He is just like a person. Now watch. She began to make a low whistling sound, so low and coaxing that it could only have been heard in entire stillness. She did it several times, looking entirely absorbed in it. Ermengarde thought she looked as if she were working a spell, and at last, evidently in response to it, a gray-whiskered, bright-eyed head peeped out of the hole. Sarah had some crumbs in her hand. She dropped them, and Melchizedek came quietly forth and ate them. A piece of larger size than the rest he took and carried in the most businesslike manner back to his home. You see, said Sarah, that this is for his wife and children. He is very nice. He only eats the little bits. After he goes back, I can always hear his family squeaking for joy. There are three kinds of squeaks. One kind is the children's, and one is Mrs. Melchizedek's, and one is Melchizedek's own. Ermengarde began to laugh. Oh, Sarah, she said, you are queer, but you are nice. I know I am queer, admitted Sarah cheerfully, and I tried to be nice. She rubbed her forehead with her little brown paw, and a puzzled, tender look came into her face. Papa always laughed at me, she said, but I liked it. He thought I was queer, but he liked me to make things up, but he liked me to make up things. I can't help making up things. If I didn't, I don't believe I could live. She paused and glanced around the attic. I'm sure I couldn't live here, she added in a low voice. Ermengarde was interested, as she always was. When you talk about things, she said, they seem as if they grew real. You talk about Melchizedek as if he was a person. He is a person, said Sarah. He gets hungry and frightened just as we do, and he is married and has children. How do we know he doesn't think things just as we do? His eyes look as if he was a person. That was why I gave him a name. She sat down on the floor in her favorite attitude, holding her knees. Besides, she said, he is a Bastille rat sent to be my friend. I can always get a bit of bread and cook the cook has thrown away, and it is quite enough to support him. Is it the Bastille yet? Asked Ermengarde eagerly. Do you always pretend it is the Bastille? Nearly always, answered Sarah. Sometimes I try to pretend it is another kind of place. But the Bastille is generally easiest, particularly when it is cold. Just at that moment, Ermengarde almost jumped off the bed. She was so startled by a sound she heard. It was like two distinct knocks on the wall. What is that? She exclaimed. Sarah got up from the floor and answered quite dramatically, It is the prisoner in the next cell. Becky, cried Ermengarde, enraptured. Yes, said Sarah. Listen, the two knocks meant prisoner. Are you there? She knocked three times on the wall herself, as if in answer. That means, yes, I am here and all is well. Four knocks came from Becky's side of the wall. That means, explained Sarah, then, fellow sufferer, we will sleep in peace. Good night. Ermengarde quite beamed with delight. Oh, Sarah, she whispered joyfully, it is like a story. It is a story, said Sarah. Everything's a story. You are a story. I am a story. Miss Minchin is a story. And she sat down again and talked until Ermengarde forgot that she was a sort of escape prisoner herself and had to be reminded by Sarah that she could not remain in the Bastille all night, but must steal noiselessly downstairs again and creep back into her deserted bed. Chapter 10. The Indian Gentleman. But it was a perilous thing for Ermengarde and Lottie to make pilgrimages to the attic. They could never be quite sure when Sarah would be there, and they could scarcely ever be certain that Miss Amelia would not make a tour of inspection through the bedrooms after the pupils were supposed to be asleep. So their visits were rare ones, and Sarah lived a strange and lonely life. It was a lonelier life when she was downstairs than when she was in her attic. She had no one to talk to, and when she was sent out on errands and walked through the streets, a forlorn little figure carrying a basket or a parcel, trying to hold her hat on when the wind was blowing, and feeling the water soak through her shoes when it was raining, she felt as if the crowds hurrying past her made her loneliness greater. When she had been the Princess Sarah, driving through the streets in her brougham, or walking attended by Mariette, the sight of her bright, eager little face and picturesque coats and hats had often caused people to look after her. A happy, beautifully cared-for little girl naturally attracts attention. Shabby, poorly dressed children are not rare enough and pretty enough to make people turn around to look at them and smile. No one looked at Sarah in these days, and no one seemed to see her as she hurried along the crowded pavements. She had begun to grow very fast, and as she was dressed only in such clothes as the plainer remnants of her wardrobe would supply, she knew she looked very queer indeed. All her valuable garments had been disposed of, and such as had been left for her use she was expected to wear so long as she could put them on at all. Sometimes when she passed a shop window with a mirror in it, she almost laughed outright on catching a glimpse of herself, and sometimes her face went red and she bit her lip and turned away. In the evening, when she passed houses whose windows were lighted up, she used to look into the warm rooms and amuse herself by imagining things about the people she saw sitting before the fires or about the tables. It always interested her to catch glimpses of rooms before the shutters were closed. There were several families in the square in which Miss Minchin lived, and with which she had become quite familiar in a way of her own. The one she liked best she called the large family. She called it the large family, not because the members of it were big, for indeed most of them were little, but because there were so many of them. There were 8 children in the large family, and a stout, rosy mother, and a stout, rosy father, and a stout, rosy grandmother, and any number of servants. The 8 children were always either being taken out to walk or to ride in perambulators by comfortable nurses, or they were going to drive with their mama, or they were flying to the door in the evening to meet their papa and kiss him and dance around him and drag off his overcoat and look in the pockets for packages, or they were reading about the nursery windows and looking out and pushing each other and laughing. In fact, they were always doing something enjoyable and suited to the tastes of a large family. Sarah was quite fond of them and had given them names out of books, quite romantic names. She called them the Montmorencies when she did not call them the large family. The fat, fair baby with the lace cap was Ethelberta Beauchamp Montmorency, and the next baby was Violet Cholmondeley Montmorency. The little boy who could just stagger and who had such round legs was Sidney Cecil Vivian Montmorency, and then came Lillian Evangeline Maud Marion, Rosalind Gladys, Guy Clarence, Veronica Eustacia, and Claude Harold Hector. One evening a very funny thing happened, though perhaps in one sense it was not a funny thing at all. Several of the Montmorencies were evidently going to a children's party, and just as Sarah was about to pass the door, they were crossing the pavement to get into the carriage which was waiting for them. Veronica, Eustacia, and Rosalind Gladys, in white lace frocks and lovely sashes, had just got in, and Guy Clarence, aged 5, was following them. He was such a pretty fellow, and had such rosy cheeks and blue eyes, and such a darling little round head covered with curls, that Sarah forgot her basket and shabby cloak altogether. In fact, forget everything but that she wanted to look at him for a moment, so she paused and looked. It was Christmas time, and the large family had been hearing many stories about children who were poor and had no mamas and papas to fill their stockings and take them to the pantomime, children who were, in fact, cold and thinly clad and hungry. In the stories, kind people, sometimes little boys and girls with tender hearts, invariably saw the poor children and gave them money or rich gifts, or took them home to beautiful dinners. Guy Clarence had been affected to tears that very afternoon by the reading of such a story, and he had burned with a desire to find such a poor child and give her a certain sixpence he possessed, and thus provide for her for life. An entire sixpence, he was sure, would mean affluence for evermore. As he crossed the strip of red carpet laid across the pavement from the door to the carriage, he had this very sixpence in the pocket of his short, very short man-o'-war trousers, and just as Rosalind Gladys got into the vehicle and jumped on the seat in order to feel the cushions spring under her, he saw Sarah standing on the wet pavement in her shabby frock and hat with her old basket on her arm, looking at him hungrily. He thought that her eyes looked hungry because she had perhaps had nothing to eat for a long time. He did not know that they looked so because she was hungry for the warm, merry life his home held and his rosy face spoke of, but that she had a hungry wish to snatch him in her arms and kiss him. He only knew that she had big eyes and a thin face and thin legs and a common basket and poor clothes. So he put his hand in his pocket and found his sixpence and walked up to her benignly. "Here, poor little girl," he said. "Here is a sixpence. I will give it to you." Sarah started and all at once realized that she looked exactly like poor children she had seen in her better days, waiting on the pavement to watch her as she got out of her brougham. As she had given them pennies many a time, and she had given them pennies many a time, her face went red and then it went pale, and for a second she felt as if she could not take the dear little sixpence. "Oh no," she said, "oh no, thank you, you mustn't take it, indeed. I mustn't take it, indeed." Her voice was so unlike an ordinary street child's voice, and her manner was so like the manner of a well-bred little person, that Veronica Eustacia, whose real name was Janet, and Rosalind Gladys, who was really called Nora, leaned forward to listen. But Guy Clarence was not to be thwarted in his benevolence. He thrust the sixpence into her hand. "Yes, you must take it, poor little girl," he insisted stoutly. "You can buy things to eat with it. It is a whole sixpence." There was something so honest and kind in his face, and he looked so likely to be heartbrokenly disappointed if she did not take it, that Sarah knew she must not refuse him. To be as proud as that would be a cruel thing. So she actually put her pride in her pocket, though it must be admitted her cheeks burned. "Thank you," she said. "You are kind. Kind little darling thing." And as he scrambled joyfully into the carriage, she went away trying to smile, though she caught her breath quickly and her eyes were shining through a mist. She had known that she looked old and odd and shabby, but until now she had not known that she might be taken for a beggar. As the large family's carriage drove away, the children inside it were talking with interest and excitement. "Oh, Donald," this was Guy Clarence's name, Janet exclaimed alarmedly, "why did you offer that little girl your sixpence? I'm sure she is not a beggar." "She didn't speak like a beggar," cried Nora, "and her face really didn't look like a beggar's face." "Besides, she didn't beg," said Janet. "I was so afraid she might be angry with you. You know, it makes people angry to be taken for beggars when they are not beggars." "She wasn't angry," said Donald, a trifle dismayed, but still firm. "She laughed a little, and she said I was a kind, kind little darling thing." "And I was," stoutly. "It was my whole sixpence." Janet and Nora exchanged glances. "A beggar girl would never have said that," decided Janet. "She would have said, 'Thank your kindly little gentleman, thank your sir,' and perhaps she would have bobbed a curtsy." Sarah knew nothing about the fact, but from that time the large family was as profoundly interested in her as she was in it. Faces used to appear at the nursery windows when she passed, and many discussions concerning her were held round the fire. She is a kind of servant at the seminary, Janet said. I don't believe she belongs to anybody. I believe she is an orphan, but she is not a beggar, however shabby she looks. And afterward, she was called by all of them the little girl who is not a beggar, which was, of course, rather a long name, and sounded very funny sometimes when the youngest ones said it in a hurry. Sarah managed to bore a hole in the sixpence and hung it on an old bit of narrow ribbon round her neck. Her affection for the large family increased, as indeed her affection for everything she could love increased. She grew fonder and fonder of Becky, and she used to look forward to the 2 mornings a week when she went into the schoolroom to give the little ones their French lesson. Her small pupils loved her and strove with each other for the privilege of standing close to her and insinuating their small hands into hers. It fed her hungry heart to feel them nestling up to her. She made such friends with the sparrows that when she stood upon the table, put her head and shoulders out of the attic window, and chirped, she heard almost immediately a flutter of wings and answering twitters, and a little flock of dingy town birds appeared and alighted on the slates to talk to her and make much of the crumbs she scattered. With Melchizedek, she had become so intimate that he actually brought Mrs. Melchizedek with him sometimes, and now and then one or two of his children. She used to talk to him, and somehow he looked quite as if he understood. There had grown in her mind rather a strange feeling about Emily, who always sat and looked on at everything. It arose in one of her moments of great desolateness. She would have liked to believe or pretend to believe that Emily understood and sympathized with her. She did not like to own to herself that her only companion could feel and hear nothing. She used to put her in a chair sometimes and sit opposite to her on the old red footstool and stare and pretend about her until her own eyes would grow large with something which was almost like fear, particularly at night when everything was so still, when the only sound in the attic was the occasional sudden scurry and squeak of Melchizedek's family in the wall. One of her pretends was that Emily was a kind of good witch who could protect her. Sometimes, after she had stared at her until she was wrought up to the highest pitch of fancifulness, she would ask her questions and find herself almost feeling as if she would presently answer, but she never did. As to answering, though, said Sarah, trying to console herself, I don't answer very often. I never answer when I can help it. When people are insulting you, there is nothing so good for them as not to say a word, just to look at them and think. Miss Minchin turns pale with rage when I do it. Miss Amelia looks frightened, and so do the girls. When you will not fly into a passion, people know you are stronger than they are, because you are strong enough to hold in your rage, and they are not, and they say stupid things they wish they hadn't said afterward. There's nothing so strong as rage, except what makes you hold it in. That's stronger. It's a good thing not to answer your enemies. I scarcely ever do. Perhaps Emily is more like me than I am like myself. Perhaps she would rather not answer her friends even. She keeps it all in her heart. But though she tried to satisfy herself with these arguments, she did not find it easy. When, after a long, hard day in which she had been sent here and there, sometimes on long errands through wind and cold and rain, she came in wet and hungry and was sent out again because nobody chose to remember that she was only a child and that her slim legs might be tired and her small body might be chilled, when she had been given only harsh words and cold, slighting looks for thanks, when the cook had been vulgar and insolent, when Miss Minchin had been in her worst mood, and when she had seen the girls sneering among themselves at her shabbiness, then she was not always able to comfort her sore, proud, desolate heart with fancies when Emily merely sat upright in her old chair and stared. One of these nights, when she came up to the attic cold and hungry, with a tempest raging in her young breast, Emily's stare seemed so vacant, her sawdust legs and arms so inexpressive, that Sarah lost all control over herself. There was nobody but Emily, no one in the world, and there she sat. I shall die presently, she said at first. Emily simply stared. I can't bear this, said the poor child, trembling. I know I shall die. I'm cold, I'm wet, I'm starving to death. I've walked 1,000 miles today, and they have done nothing but scold me from morning until night. And because I could not find that last thing the cook sent me for, they would not give me any supper. Some men laughed at me because my old shoes made me slip down in the mud. I'm covered with mud now, and they laughed. Do you hear? She looked at the staring glass eyes and complacent face, and suddenly a sort of heartbroken rage seized her. She lifted her little savage hand and knocked Emily off the chair, bursting into a passion of sobbing. Sarah, who never cried. "You are nothing but a doll," she cried. "Nothing but a doll, doll, doll. You care for nothing. You are stuffed with sawdust. You never had a heart. Nothing could ever make you feel. You are a doll." Emily lay on the floor with her legs ignominiously doubled up over her head and a new flat place on the end of her nose. But she was calm, even dignified. Sarah hid her face in her arms. The rats in the wall began to fight and bite each other and squeak and scramble. Melchizedek was chastising some of his family. Sarah's sobs gradually quieted themselves. It was so unlike her to break down that she was surprised at herself. After a while, she raised her face and looked at Emily, who seemed to be gazing at her round the side of one angle, and somehow, by this time, actually with a kind of glassy-eyed sympathy. Sarah bent and picked her up. Remorse overtook her. She even smiled at herself a very little smile. "You can't help being a doll," she said with a resigned sigh, "any more than Lavinia and Jesse can help not having any sense. We are not all made alike. Perhaps you do your sawdust best." And she kissed her and shook her clothes straight and put her back upon her chair. She had wished very much that someone would take the empty house next door. She wished it because the attic window was so near hers. It seemed as if it would be so nice to see it. It seemed as if it would be so nice to see it propped open some day and a head and shoulders rising out of the square aperture. If it looked a nice head, she thought, I might begin by saying good morning, and all sorts of things might happen. But of course, it's not really likely that anyone but underservants would sleep there. One morning, on turning the corner of the square after a visit to the grocers, the butchers, and the baker, she saw to her great delight that during her rather prolonged absence, a van full of furniture had stopped before the next house. The front doors were thrown open, and men in shirt sleeves were going in and out carrying heavy packages and pieces of furniture. "It's taken," she said. "It really is taken. Oh, I do hope a nice head will look out of the attic window." She would almost have liked to join the group of loiterers who had stopped on the pavement to watch the things carried in. She had an idea that if she could see some of the furniture, she could guess something about the people it belonged to. "Miss Minchin's tables and chairs are just like her," she thought. "I remember thinking that the first minute I saw her, even though I was so little. I told Papa afterward, and he laughed and said it was true. I am sure the large family have fat, comfortable armchairs and sofas, and I can see that their red flowery wallpaper is exactly like them. It's warm and cheerful and kind-looking and happy." She was sent out for parsley to the greengrocer's later in the day, and when she came up the area steps, her heart gave a quick beat of recognition. Several pieces of furniture had been set out of the van upon the pavement. There was a beautiful table of elaborately wrought teak wood and some chairs and a screen covered with rich oriental embroidery. The sight of them gave her a weird homesick feeling. She had seen things so like them in India. One of the things Miss Minchin had taken from her was a carved teak wood desk her father had sent her. "They are beautiful things," she said. "They look as if they ought to belong to a nice person. All the things look rather grand. I suppose it is a rich family." The vans of furniture came and were unloaded and gave place to others all the day. Several times it so happened that Sarah had an opportunity of seeing things carried in. It became plain that she had been right in guessing that the newcomers were people of large means. All the furniture was rich and beautiful, and a great deal of it was oriental. Wonderful rugs and draperies and ornaments were taken from the vans, many pictures and books enough for a library. Among other things, there was the superb god Buddha in a splendid shrine. Someone in the family must have been in India, Sarah thought. They have got used to Indian things and like them. I am glad. I shall feel as if they were friends, even if a head never looks out of the attic window. When she was taken in the evening's milk for the cook, There was really no odd job she was not called upon to do. She saw something occur which made the situation more interesting than ever. The handsome, rosy man, who was the father of the large family, walked across the square in the most matter-of-fact manner and ran up the steps of the next-door house. He ran up them as if he felt quite at home and expected to run up and down them many a time in the future. He stayed inside quite a long time and several times came out and gave directions to the workmen as if he had a right to do so. It was quite certain that he was in some intimate way connected with the newcomers and was acting for them. If the new people have children, Sarah speculated, the large family children will be sure to come and play with them, and they might come up into the attic just for fun. At night, after her work was done, Becky came in to see her fellow prisoner and bring her news. "It's an Indian gentleman that's coming to live next door, miss," she said. "I don't know whether he's a black gentleman or not, but he's an Indian one. He's very rich, and he's ill, and the gentleman of the large family is his lawyer. He's had a lot of trouble, and it's made him ill and low in his mind. He worships idols, miss. He's an heathen, and bows down to wood and stone. I see an idol being carried in for him to worship. Somebody had oughter send him a track. You can get a track for a penny." Sarah laughed a little. "I don't believe he worships that idol," she said. "Some people like to keep them to look at because they are interesting. My papa had a beautiful one, and he did not worship it." But Becky was rather inclined to prefer to believe that the new neighbor was an heathen. It sounded so much more romantic than that he should merely be the ordinary kind of gentleman who went to church with a prayer book. She sat and talked long that night of what he would be like and what his wife would be like if he had one, and of what his children would be like if they had children. Sarah saw that privately she could not help hoping very much that they would all be black and would wear turbans, and above all, that, like their parents, they would all be heathens. I've never lived next door to no heathens, miss," she said. "I should like to see what sort of ways they'd have." It was several weeks before her curiosity was satisfied, and then it was revealed that the new occupant had neither wife nor children. He was a solitary man with no family at all, and it was evident that he was shattered in health and unhappy in mind. A carriage drove up one day and stopped before the house. When the footman dismounted from the box and opened the door, the gentleman who was the father of the large family got out first. After him there descended a nurse in uniform, then came down the steps two men servants. They came to assist their master, who, when he was helped out of the carriage, proved to be a man with a haggard, distressed face and a skeleton body wrapped in furs. He was carried up the steps, and the head of the large family went with him, looking very anxious. Shortly afterward, a doctor's carriage arrived, and the doctor went in, plainly to take care of him. "There is such a yellow gentleman next door, Sarah," Lottie whispered at the French class afterward. "Do you think he is Chinee?" "The geography says the Chinee men are yellow." "No, he is not Chinese," Sarah whispered back. "He is very ill. Go on with your exercise, Lottie." "Non, monsieur, je n'ai pas la canif de mon oncle." That was the beginning of the story of the Indian gentleman.